Morning, everybody. Before I start, I've been given a note that says we need special prayer as well as the Toby prayer for Reynold Gilson. He is very sick and he is in hospital. So if you could add that to your praying activities, that would be excellent as well. Can I just get the screen on the back, fellas? That would be really good. So here we are, just inches away from Christmas. It's only just over a week since Road to Bethlehem finished. Probably should turn that on. That'll work a little bit better. We've got this little lull in between Road to Bethlehem and Christmas. And I was thinking a bit about Road to Bethlehem. Road to Bethlehem is like this Christmas miracle that happens every year associated with our church. And if you're involved this year, thank you very much for your assistance with that, because it takes something like 700 people volunteering their different talents and abilities to come together. So coordinating 700 people to make something happen is always a bit of a miracle. And we had the honour this year of over 15,000 people coming through for us to tell the story of the birth of Jesus. So it was a great honour. Now, I've been involved with Road to Bethlehem for 25 years. Mostly, I'm most known for some egregious overacting. Sorry, Scott. but there's another part that I'm a little bit involved with, which is the script for the play itself. Let me get rid of that photo. Let me show this lovely photo of our granddaughter, who's an excellent baby Jesus this year, continuing the family tradition. So the other thing that I do behind the scenes is I'm involved with the script writing, which my dad would be sort of proud of, because he was a script writer by trade, so it's nice for me to carry on something of a family tradition there. So if you've been to Road to Bethlehem and you liked what was said, you enjoyed what was said, well, I'll take full credit for that. And if you didn't like it, well, that was somebody ad-libbing and messing it all up. So I'll take no credit for that at all. But having said that, with my involvement with the script, sometimes I look at the script and go, it'd be really nice to put a bit more emphasis on that or develop that idea a little bit more, but you're kind of limited for time. So today is my opportunity to talk about the bits of the Christmas story that don't fit into the Road to Bethlehem experience, but are still part of that rich, remarkable event. And there's three things I want to look at this morning, and I'm calling them paradoxes. That was the heading of the thing, the three paradoxes of Christmas. And a paradox is a statement or a situation or a concept that seems to contradict itself or defy logic. It may still reveal a deeper truth. So let me give you some examples. Example number one, deep down you're a shallow person. Okay, all right. See how it makes you think about stuff? And here's another one. The only constant in life is change. So it sounds sort of logically inconsistent, but it reveals a deeper truth. All right, so that's what a paradox is, in case you're wondering what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the three paradoxes of Christmas. All right, let's fire this up and get into it. So there's a moment in the Christmas story where involving King Herod. Now, historians regard him generally as a fairly insecure, even paranoid kind of a ruler. And so he gets wind that there might be a new threat to his throne, a baby who is born, who will be king of the Jews. And because he's paranoid, what he does is he gets the teachers of the law together and the chief priests, and he asks them, okay, so where is this baby, this Messiah figure, supposed to be born? And they have an answer for him, and they pull out something from the prophet Micah. It was written some 700 years before this moment. And so they recite this scripture to him, which you can read in Matthew 2:9. This is a quote from the Old Testament. They tell him, "But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." Now, the Matthew text, and indeed the Road to Bethlehem script, cuts off at that point, at one who will be the shepherd of my people Israel. But it's worth going back to the original Micah text, because there's another sentence in that quote that gets dropped out that's really, really interesting. So if we actually read the whole thing in Micah 5:2, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, Though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel. So the same sort of idea. But then the rest of the statement goes this, like this, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. So that last little bit doesn't appear in the Christmas narrative, and translators are not completely agreed on how it should be translated or what it actually implies. So I went to the word-for-word translation, which is the New American Standard, and it says, what it means is, literally, his goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. So what's cool about that is that Micah is kind of looking down the telescope of time and saying, look, he's looking 700 years into the future and saying, someone pretty special is going to come along 700 years in the future. But he actually comes from way in the past. In fact, he's outside of time. He's always been here. He's always been. So there's a paradox. How can that be? So remember the definition of a paradox. Defies logic but may reveal a deeper truth. So that baby is, of course, Jesus. Jesus is God. He has always been. And it's really the same idea that's expressed by the disciple John when he opens up his gospel account. John seems to be the most literate of the gospel writers. So he writes quite eloquently, like my talking. When he opens up his gospel account, he says, in the beginning was the Word, Jesus, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. So yes, Micah is a prophecy about where Jesus the Messiah would be born, but there's this other dimension to it that actually makes it a statement of great theological significance. As C.S. Lewis would put it, the eternal being who knows everything and who created the whole universe became not only a man, but before that, a baby. And before even that, a fetus inside a woman's body. So there's kind of a glorious paradox contained in this verse, in this prophecy, that the vastness of God, the same one who knows all things, who created everything, who existed before all of that, all that we see and know on the earth, the one who is from all eternity enters our time and space in really the most limited human form possible, a newborn baby. So that's the first paradox found in the Christmas story. Jesus comes as a baby, but his origin is from everlasting, from eternity. So the second paradox also comes up in the same verse, and really a few other verses too, concerning the actual event of the birth of Jesus. So where was Jesus born? He was born in Bethlehem, as the prophecy says. Now, in our present day, armed with what we know of the past, of history, we can say, oh yes, Jesus was born in Bethlehem and just walk on and nothing to see here. Because Bethlehem is significant to us because Jesus was born there. But Bethlehem, at that time, before Jesus was born, what was Bethlehem? Well, it's the place that King David was born, and that's about it. I saw a quote somewhere, I can't remember where, which is unfortunate, but it says that Bethlehem existed in quiet obscurity. Now, if you're going to change the world, impact the world, save the world, you would imagine that being at the epicentre of economic and political activity would be the place to start, perhaps. And at that time, that was Rome, one of the most significant cities in history, the eternal city, if you like. And here is a rendering of the Roman Empire at the time of the birth of Jesus. Now, you won't be able to read all the names there, but let me do some pointing out. So Rome is here, which you can see is neatly in the centre of this area that they were responsible for. I love the fact they put Hadrian's Wall here because they just couldn't deal with the Scots. Anyway, they put a wall up and just said, let's forget about them. That's the limits. So that's where the epicentre of this empire is. Now, where was Jesus born? Well, over here in Judea, right on the fringes of the empire. And the big city there was Jerusalem. Was he born there? No, he was not. If you go down the road from Jerusalem, you find a tiny little town, maybe a few thousand people. And that is the town of Bethlehem. I think the term backwater is quite an appropriate term to use for Bethlehem at that time. It was nowhere. It was Nothing. I was looking for a comparison for this, and I was curious to see, for example, where the current King of England was born, King Charles III. And he was born in Buckingham Palace in London. And that is what you would expect from somebody in that position, that he'd be born in a palace in a major important city that looked sort of gilded and important like this. But how did Jesus, the most important person who ever lived, arrive in an obscure little village at the fringes of the empire? And more than that, remember, there was no room at the inn. So he entered the world in a stable or even a cave. And his first bed was, in fact, an animal feed trough, otherwise known as a manger. And not long after that, this little family were refugees from political violence. So he had no proper home, no community, no roots, no stability, no security. It seems like an unimpressive, or at least a disadvantaged, start in life. Now, why is that important? I mean, it wasn't just misfortune that it worked out that way. It's actually an important aspect of the story. And there's two reasons why that is important for today. One is summarised by a hymn that used to be sung in the early Christian churches, which you can find quoted in Paul's letter to the Philippian church. He talks about you should have the attitude like Christ Jesus, who, this is where the hymn starts, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself. He made himself nothing, or he emptied himself. Though he was from eternity, from everlasting, the very author of life, when he enters into this life, he showed absolute humility. There was no glory, no dignity even in the circumstances of his birth. And in that process, he actually redefined what greatness looks like, what greatness is. It's not about status. It's not about riches. It's not about power or pomp or domineering. It's about self-sacrifice, even the ultimate sacrifice, which we haven't got to that bit yet, but it's coming. But this was his first step in redefining what greatness looks like, the absolute humbleness of his birthplace and his birth circumstances. So that's one thing this shows, the humility of Jesus in his birth. The second thing that it shows is that nothing can stop the power of God. Jesus may have started off in a place of quiet obscurity with no political, financial, military, or even geographical advantages, but he went on to live the one life that has had more impact on the world than any other life before or since. And that speaks of a power that is beyond all those conventional benefits and advantages, and a power that is superior to them as well. What was Jesus armed with that enabled him to do that? He was armed with his words, his compassion, and the Holy Spirit. And that's about it. And yet, we can trace how dramatically he has affected the world, how he's affected history and continues to do so 2,000 years later. So his birthplace of Bethlehem reminds us of his willingness to humble himself and the unstoppable power of his life and ministry. And that's our second paradox. Our great king, the great king, came to us in absolute humility, and in so doing began to redefine what greatness is as being about self-sacrifice. The third paradox for Christmas for today is a detail that shows up in the entry of the wise men into the story. And it points to an event that was future to the birth of Jesus. Now, look, we don't know how many wise men actually made the trek to visit Jesus at his birth. We don't really know exactly where they were from, other than they were from the east. We don't really even know how they knew to come, other than following a star. But I want to look at that a little bit, because we know what they brought. We know they brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now, these are all valuable items. Gold is gold. It's always been valuable, probably will remain so. I was wondering how valuable is gold. So I looked it up this week. If you had 100 grams of gold, which is about what a bar of soap weighs, so not a huge amount of gold, that would be worth $20,000. So gold is very valuable. Frankincense. Now, how does that differ from regular incense? Well, frank basically means high quality or pure incense. So frankincense is like really good incense. So it's top shelf incense, if you'd like to see it that way. Hence, for example, in Isaiah 60, where Isaiah is writing about the restoration of Jerusalem, there's a quote here about how riches are going to flow back to Jerusalem. A multitude of camels will cover you, the young camels of Midian and Ephah. All those from Sheba will come. They will bring gold and frankincense. So it's an occasion of celebration and joy. Proclaim good news of the praise of the Lord. But what's with the myrrh? It was also a highly valuable commodity. It was used medicinally and in some worship rituals, but its primary use was as an embalming thing. In fact, one of the accounts of the burial of Jesus himself from the Gospel of John says, Nicodemus, the man who had previously come to Jesus at night, accompanied Joseph carrying a mixture of myrrh and aloes weighing about 75 pounds, which is a lot. Then they took Jesus' body and wrapped it with the aromatic spices in strips of linen cloth according to Jewish burial customs. So these wise men give this as a gift to a baby that they believed was very special, in fact going to be a king, even the Messiah, the anointed one. So they give a baby this gift that has this association with death. Now, what's all that about? Well, there's a tradition or even an implication that these wise men had some degree of knowledge of Old Testament prophecy that led to this journey that they took. So they don't just see a star and think, well, that's interesting, but let's follow that. They seem to already be looking for some kind of sign. And one possible reason for that is that they may have had some grounding in the prophecies of Daniel, who was an Old Testament man of God who lived most of his life not in Israel, but in the east, in Babylon, in what is now Iraq. So this just gives you an idea of... Daniel's one of the few Old Testament prophets who actually lived and worked outside of Israel. Most of them were Israel and in Israel and inwardly focused. He actually lived most of his life over here, right over there in modern-day Iraq near Baghdad in Babylon, which is about 1,000 kilometres away from Jerusalem. And why was he there? Well, he was, he along with most of the nation of Israel in the 6th century BC, was taken off into captivity. They were in Israel and they got taken off to Babylon. And it was captivity that lasted for 70 years. But at the end of that captivity, when the Jews were allowed to go back home, most of them didn't. They actually stayed there. In 70 years, they'd established enough roots and security to think, oh, I don't really want to go back there to something that's unknown and undefined. I know what I've got here, so I think I'll just stay here. So, in fact, Babylon, for the next few hundred years, was one of the largest centres of Jewish life outside of Israel. So the influence of Daniel would have persisted in that area significantly, and this is presumably, or likely to be, the kind of area the wise men came from. And why does that matter? Okay, well, it matters because Daniel had a prophecy that laid out a 490-year timeline as to when the Messiah would show up. And if these men are versed in that, then they're looking for signs because they can do the calculations and go, well, something's going to happen around about now. So they're on the lookout for what could be an indication that we're actually on the right track here. And then the star pops up and they go, aha. That could be the thing. I can't go through the whole prophecy, but I just want to say there is that 490-year timeline. But also in that prophecy, in the same prophecy, there's a part that says this person will be cut off, will be cut down, or will be killed. So that's one version in the NSAB. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing, or another more frank version, which is the NIV, after the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be put to death and will have nothing. So did they know that? Did they know it and act on that and think, okay, there's something significant about this. Okay, he's going to come, but he's actually going to die. So do we need to give something that's going to take account for that? Now look, in the end, it doesn't truly matter what they know because their decision was in some way spirit-led anyway. They may not have known the significance of what they were doing, but they still did it in order to put, at the moment of his birth, the smallest foreshadowing of his ultimate death. And that's the third paradox. Even at his birth, there is a link to his death. And that's because his death was not just some random, unfortunate event. It was an event of massive significance, as outlined by another great Old Testament prophet who wrote, again, 700 years earlier, Isaiah 53. Well, that's small. He suffered the things we should have suffered. He looked took on himself the pain that should have been ours. But the servant was pierced because we had sinned. He was crushed because we had done what was evil. He was punished to make us whole again. His wounds have healed us. All of us are like sheep. We have wandered away from God. All of us have turned to our own way. And the Lord has placed on his servant the sins of all of us. So that was, again, written 700 years before the death of Jesus, the death he would face on the cross. And that death was because of what we have done and of who we are. He suffered the things we should have suffered. He took on himself the pain that should have been ours. We're all sinners. We're all in rebellion against God. And the inevitable consequence of that is death. So Jesus took our sin, that consequence on himself, and took it to the cross, and it died with him. Why? Because his wounds have healed us. He was punished to make us whole again. And we don't just get the avoidance of punishment. We get a whole new standing with God. He makes us right in the eyes of God. His death changes everything. So, at Christmas, we have these three paradoxes. We have the one who is eternal enters as a baby. We have, that's weird, isn't it? The King of all kings comes to us in quiet obscurity and in absolute humility. And finally, in the light of his birth, we see the shadow of his death. And you might hear all that and go, well, so what? I said earlier on that a paradox is something that seems contradictory or defies logic, but may reveal a deeper truth. And I think that applies here. Because as people, our hearts look to and look for something beyond ourselves, bigger than ourselves. We look for the mind behind the universe, the presence at the heart of the universe. Every culture throughout the world, throughout history, has some sort of religious observance, some form of worship of a god or gods. You can see, wherever you go, you'll see some sort of manifestation of man's quest to try and know and understand the God behind the whole universe. That is a cry of the heart. It cries out to know what is beyond us and to understand it. Even atheists admit this. Richard Dawkins, well-known atheist, was asked, what do you think the strongest evidence for the existence of God is? And he said, it is the feeling that there is something more than meets the eye. So the human heart is looking for that. That's something more beyond what the eye can see. And the prophet Micah tells us that the one who would be born out of Bethlehem, who would be that ruler, even though he's born at a specific time and place in history, about 2,000 years ago, his origins were well before and well above that. His origins are from everlasting. So Christmas speaks to our longing for a God who is beyond us and behind everything we know and see. But our hearts want more than just a big God. Our hearts cry out for a God who will come near to us, not be far off from us and aloof. And so he's born in Bethlehem, a tiny town with no great status or standing, far, far from power and influence, and his first cradle was a manger. So this God, who is above and behind everything we know, utterly humbles himself in the nature of his birth. He places no barrier, no distance between himself and us. Isaiah, when he wrote of the coming of the Messiah, he used the name Emmanuel. Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. And Emmanuel means God with us. So while he is from everlasting, above and beyond, behind all things, Christmas reminds us that he has come near to us. He's like one of us. He is our brother. He's the one who has walked the dusty roads like we do. But our hearts want for even more than that. So he's at once beyond us and with us. But the myrrh tells us that he would do more than just be with us and come alongside of us. The myrrh tells us that he would die for us. John wrote this, recording the words of Jesus, "Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends." So at Christmas, in the smallest of ways, in the nature of one of the gifts given by the wise men from the East, the first Christmas presents, if you like, it speaks of his eventual sacrifice for us and speaks of our longing for a God who loves us, who would go all the way to death for us. And so at Christmas, we see these three dimensions. He's from everlasting, so he's above and beyond us. He's born in Bethlehem, laid in a manger. He's with us. He's one of us. We see that he's given myrrh to signify the laying down of his life. We see that he loves us. We see all that together, and our hearts can be full. And there is joy to the world, which we're now going to sing.